It's a summer space news roundup. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. There's been a lot happening on the space beat, including a Space Academy, SpaceX's expansion, and Blue Origin's race to launch New Glenn once again.
There is a lot of urgency around getting New Glenn flying. That's the company's primary mission, and it's clear that they are playing a critical role in NASA's moon program.
And space news just isn't all happening here in the U.S.
There's been a major upheaval in Europe in the last couple of years of, like, what should we go work on now? Because we're not getting along with the U.S. as much anymore. There was a moment where they were collaborating with China in terms of training astronauts.
We'll hear from Ars Technica's Eric Berger and Off Nominal's Anthony Colangelo about some of the recent news on the space beat. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's been a busy summer for space news, including commercial space stories. SpaceX announced plans to build a new spaceport in Louisiana with the aim of launching its mega rocket Starship up to 30 times a day from those pads. Blue Origin is racing to repair its launch pad after an explosion in May crippled the facility. And another space company announced it raised some $1 billion in new funding. Here to talk more about the big space news stories this summer is Eric Berger. He's the senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff, and he co-hosts the podcast Off Nominal. Eric, Anthony, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Always good to be here.
Okay, so lots to talk about. Wrap up of space news this summer. Start with the big ones, SpaceX and Blue Origin, and begin with SpaceX. Eric, let's talk a bit about SpaceX's plans in Louisiana, because this is a massive project that they announced, right?
This would be the largest spaceport ever constructed on planet Earth. It would be all built by a private company. I think the biggest difference is, you know, in South Texas, they have a couple hundred acres to work with. They have a single road, you know, two-lane road that goes out to their site that they share with beachgoers. In Louisiana, they're going to have more than 100,000 acres. They can build whatever roads they want. They're going to have a local government that's clearly ready to play ball. I foresee a future in which Louisiana becomes the epicenter of SpaceX's operations over the course of the next decade. You know, the idea of building 10 or 12 launch towers for the largest rocket in the world is a massive undertaking, but this is a well-capitalized company. And if they're going to reach their ambitions, they've got to have something like this. So they're all in on Louisiana. I think it's a huge deal.
Does it come as a surprise to you, Anthony, that they chose Louisiana for this?
No. I mean, I feel like I should have guessed this. I was given a riddle before this was announced, like, months ago, that this was land purchase was being made in a state that hasn't hosted an orbital launch site yet. And I'm, like, annoyed that I didn't think of this, because when you look at a lot of the government stuff that Eric's talking about is very important. But then when I look at the architecture side, what they need to launch in the next couple of decades, thousands of data center satellites that are going to be in sun synchronous orbit. You went ahead basically straight south, a little bit west of straight south. You got an awesome stretch of water in front of you from the coast of Louisiana. And what I find most interesting is actually the return as well. So if you're launching south out of Louisiana into a sun synchronous orbit, the Earth's going to spin under you. You are repeating over a ground track on a certain amount of time. 12 hours later, you've got an approach trajectory back to the launch site to come all over water and get caught at the tower. It is not only a great launch site, it's a great landing site for Starship. When you compare it to Boca Chica, you are maybe going to be buzzing Eric's house in Houston or coming up over Mexico. Or Florida coming over your house, you know, you two are in the target zone of Starship reentries. But when you're coming back, heading north up over the Gulf and landing at this site, it's a really, you could see really smooth operations. Launching south, landing north, and you've got, you know, there's some things that you might be worried about interrupting there, but it fits their architecture, what they need to launch in the next couple of years. You think about pairing those orbits with orbital refilling, propellant depots. You see a coalescing of infrastructure there that makes a lot of sense for what they're interested in the next couple of years.
The main concern I have is that this is pretty unstable landscape. Southern Louisiana, there's been some subsidence issues. There's lots of erosion along the Northern Gulf coast. It's been a problem for years. They're losing a lot of land. And with rising sea levels, you know, the problem gets exacerbated. So they're going to have to do some real work to protect that area in terms of making sure they remain above sea level. So from a viability standpoint, and also, you know, just having lived in Houston now for more than two decades and written about hurricanes at the time, that area of Louisiana gets hit by a lot of hurricanes. That's another concern. Not saying that they don't face that in South Texas or near you in Florida. Historically, that is really Hurricane Alley. But setting that aside, it's perfect as a place to just build a massive base of operations.
And they've got their, another thing was this pipeline that they have access to there that is very cheap natural gas. They need, you know, all the methane in the world, basically.
You know, everything from solar, they get a lot of sunshine on the Gulf Coast to natural gas. Yes, they are going to build their idealized spaceport. And they've had a lot of experience now working in Cape Canaveral in Florida, Vandenberg, then kind of building up their own site in South Texas. Now everything is just going to be on steroids because they've got an enormous amount of capital and they've got an enormous amount of real estate and from and a regulatory environment that's going to allow them to go fast.
It's an enormous amount of launch pads and projected launches, right? Something like up to 30 a day. I mean, is this going to happen? Will we get to a point where they're launching 30 starships a day from Louisiana?
That depends entirely on whether orbital data centers are viable. If you are going to get to a constellation of 1 million orbital data center satellites, and I can't really wrap my head around that yet, but I've done the calculations and talked to people, and you would need something like 20, 30, 40 launches a day. So this is the infrastructure that they would need to support that vision. I think there are real questions to still be asked about the viability of orbital data centers. I do think we're going to need a lot of compute in the coming years, so they're right about that. But you know, whether it's economically viable to build those, I mean, could you take that 125,000 acres in Louisiana and just put up a massive amount of solar panels and build data centers on the ground? I think so. Economically, how does that trade with data centers in space? I don't know. But if orbital data centers are the future of the economy in space, then this is the right bet to make.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. We're talking about the commercial space news stories that have been happening these past few months. Let's move on to another commercial space company, Blue Origin. It suffered a setback with an explosion at its pad, but Blue Origin is rebuilding. What do we know about where they're at, and will they meet their goal of launching by the end of the year?
We all thought it was going to take a lot longer than it probably will end up taking. And some of the stuff I've been hearing recently about looking more like the early days of Boca Chica, where some of this infrastructure in the early days feels more throwaway, or we know we're going to replace all of these elements after each launch, but we want to get flying and then build the permanent thing. They've taken more of a rapidly iterating approach to rebuilding the launch pad than I thought they would have, leaning more on traditional cranes and things that aren't so bespoke. And remember some of the post-explosion time period, people talking about the transporter erector that they had built for their first pad and how it was such a long project. It was so extensive within the company to actually get to the point where they built that thing out. I don't feel like I'm hearing any of that out of the updates out of Cape Canaveral. And that gives me hope that they're thinking about it differently, that they're approaching it differently than we've all, you know, got a Blue Origin bias about the way they typically work. So that gives me some hope. I don't know exactly where they're going to land, but they haven't backed off their dates as quickly as I thought they would have.
I stood next to that transporter erector. It absolutely was a tank. It was a monstrous land vehicle. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything larger than that. So yeah, if they were going to have to rebuild that, it was multiple years to get back to launch. They're taking, I agree with everything Anthony said. They're acting in a very un Blue Origin-like manner, using the crane to put the rocket in place in the launch tower. I think is not great for rapid reuse, but it is great if you are trying to get back launching as soon as possible. I think that's clearly the mandate from Jeff Bezos and Dave Limp to Blue Origin. They're moving more quickly certainly than I expected them to. I'm still pretty confident that they're not going to launch this year, but it would not be shocking to me if the launch pad is very nearly ready by the end of the year and they're launching pretty quickly in early 2027. It's an impressive response from them. I think it's reflective of two things. Number one, there is a lot of urgency around getting New Glenn flying. That's the company's primary mission. And it's clear that they are playing a critical role in NASA's moon program. And it's important, I think, to Jeff Bezos for his legacy to play that. I think the other thing that hasn't been talked about as much, but maybe is even more important, is the fact that Bezos is trying to sell equity in Blue Origin. And that only becomes valuable if you actually have a flying rocket. And I think before the anomaly, he was pretty close to inking that deal. And then the anomaly set things back. So I think this urgency reflects his desire to bring outside capital into Blue Origin as quickly as possible.
Let's talk about another commercial space company that we don't always talk about on this show, but has raised $1 billion, Stoke Space. What's Stoke's plan?
Stoke is a very interesting company that working on fully reusable launch vehicle, reusable first stage, reusable second stage, different approach than you might think, where they've got different kind of engine up on that upper stage with a sort of integrated heat shield system. So it's a incredibly different approach than you're seeing in other companies. So, you know, the roster of people that have moved on from other companies to go and found and then join Stoke in the early days also gives a lot of interest to the storyline. And then the amount of money they raised, right? We've only really heard a company raise, they're up to $2.3 billion total capital raised, and they have not yet made their first launch attempt. That is probably only comparable to something like Relativity, who raised an enormous amount of money, didn't get, you know, had a hard time getting the launch pad, changed plans very quickly after the first Terran 1 flight. I think a lot of people can look at that and say, well, that makes me a little nervous that we have such untested technology getting $2.3 billion of funding. And then now I think, feel like if you told me yesterday they were going to raise $1 billion and announce this, I could have written the press release without actually having seen this news, because it's like, we raised $1 billion. We're accelerating our plans on our upgraded vehicle because our performance came in a little low in the first vehicle that we're actually putting out there to the launch pad. It feels very as expected, but I think that's a good thing, because it doesn't, it, you know, means that Stoke is actually making progress through their technical roadmap. You know, you see other storylines like Rocket Lab's Neutron that has had a lot of technical delays and a lot of issues in the last year. So you can compare the way that they're moving through their announcements, and I feel good about the way that Stoke's moving through their roadmap right now, but they're coming up on first launch within the next year feels pretty reasonable to me. They say early 27 per Mr. Berger's reporting. How early is early? Is early May 31st or is early January 31st? I think either one's a win, honestly.
Yeah, Eric, tell us a bit about that reporting that came out this morning on Tuesday when we're chatting.
First of all, like, I think if you're sort of a casual space interested person, you look at the commercial space and you say, well, there's Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and a bunch of other people. And are these really sympathetic people to be rooting for? Maybe not, right? But I have to say that the people at Stoke, starting with CEO Andy Laps, are genuinely nice people, very likable. So if you're looking for a horse to back in the space race, they're good people. I mean, you can look at Andy's bio on X, and I think the first thing he says is father. It's important to him. I talked to Andy last week about this fundraise. Obviously, it's an impressive amount. I think, you know, what differentiates it from Relativity is that it's coming 3, 4, 5 years later in a different fundraising environment, with the fact that many people investing in this round perhaps also invested in Relativity and got burnt, right? Because those shares became worthless, essentially, when Eric Schmidt bought the company. And so the fact that they're able to raise this much capital in this environment, I think, is impressive. And it speaks to the fact that they are doing really interesting things. I did visit their factory a month or so ago, and it's clearly, they're hardware rich. These are real rockets that are going to fly. They're building, you know, building other vehicles in the flow. So it's like, it's not going to be a one-off. So there's a lot to like about Stoke. Obviously, we're going to have to see how that first flight goes. And the second flight, that, you know, they're going to phase in their full reuse plan. So it's not like they're going to be landing first and second stages on the first flight. It's going to be a process. But they clearly are committed to the right vision, I think, which is, look, the end state of launch is going to be rapid reuse, full reuse. And so why not just start making those hard trades right at the beginning? And yeah, they're an impressive company. And you know, we'll see. I agree with Anthony. If they launch in the first half of next year, that's a huge win.
Very cool stuff happening at Cape Canaveral. We had a chance to check out their launch facility
Don't touch
while
this
back.
One. And don't touch this one.
I didn't touch
Terran
anything.
One.
I promise you I didn't touch anything
one.
Of this one.
I don't know.
There was no hardware down here. Okay. There's no hardware down here.
The launch site, by the way, is pretty much done. So
yeah,
they're waiting on the first and second stages to ship out.
Mm-hmm. And that's a historic launch site too, right? That was John Glenn's launch site, I believe.
Yes.
14, yeah.
Stuff there. Yeah.
Also was right next to Blue Origin's pad when it went pop, and they did some minor damage to their vehicle integration facility or hangar, but no damage to the launch site.
We're speaking with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff, about the space news stories that have happened this summer. From rocket science to political science, space policy, and international relations, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We've been speaking with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. We've been talking about updates in the world of commercial space. We turn our attention to other space news stories like the U.S.'s announcement of the Space Academy, a shakeup in international space policy, and what's ahead for the rest of 2026. Our conversation with Eric and Anthony continues. Let's get political here. Eric, Anthony, Space Academy, an announcement. Were we surprised by this? What do we know about President Trump's ideas for Space Academy?
Well, I was not surprised. I had a heads up that morning that it was coming. But I do think it's a significant announcement. And it's an interesting vision. It's kind of a tricky one to message because the intent clearly here is to graduate civil cadets. Like you know, you go to the school, you get free education, and then you spend 4 or 6 years, I don't know the amount of time, working for the government. Now, graduates will be able to go to the Space Force, which is a military branch, but the intent is for most of them to go to the civil branch. But of course, most of the academies are all the academies we have to date are military service academies, like West Point and so forth. So it's going to be a messaging challenge. And of course, Trump, during his remarks that day, talked about Space Force and not so much NASA with regard to the academy. But what I can tell you is that behind the scenes, there's an extraordinary amount of interest here in Texas, where I live. The officials I'm talking to are saying no one is going to outbid Texas for the Space Academy. I think Florida's
doing the same.
Probably feels the same way, and other locations as well.
So we're going to get it in New Jersey. I know.
It might need to go to Jersey, yeah. But I think it'd probably be close to an existing space facility. So you're thinking places like Alabama, Florida, Texas, potentially, you know, somewhere else. But probably if it's awarded in the next 2.5 years to a conservative leaning state, just the way things are right now. But it's interesting, and I think it's valuable. It's space flight has clearly made enormous changes in the last 20 years. And so the future of NASA is how do you leverage the considerable commercial capabilities of industry while also being a forward-looking space agency? And so the job of a NASA civil servant is changing. And I think you want to train people who are sort of ready to lead the space agency into whatever the future brings. So I like it from that intent, but I'll be keeping a close eye on the politics of it all.
Anthony, on the commercial side of things, are these commercial companies looking towards this as just another avenue for contracts, way to make money, things like that?
I don't know. This is a tough storyline for me to get my head around, to be honest, because in this administration has had such a touch and go relationship with attracting, retaining, keeping talent around, right? We spent the first, you know, the pre-Isaacman era, I would say, the Sean Duffy NASA era. That year, right, the bleak year that we all were going through, there was a huge departure of people within NASA, just, and not NASA only, right? There was many organizations in the government going through this between DOGE and everything else that was happening. Just a huge, you know, letting out of this talent. And then you get Isaacman coming in saying, well, we want to rebuild the core competencies of NASA. For the people I've talked to who were civil servants that are then having their jobs turned into actual government roles, that has not gone smoothly. People are not happy with that transition process. It has been a lot of upheaval in ways that the people that are in those jobs don't really think are good. And that makes me think, like, well, is this the case where someone is coming in with a new initiative and the people that are already there, the entrenched interests, are not interested in changing because they like the way it was? You know, that's not the way my daddy's NASA was, and it won't be the way my NASA is. Is it that, or is this legitimately a bad idea? Just separating that, because of how political everything is a tough storyline to unravel. And then you get this announcement of like, all right, well, we're going to inject a bunch of new people in there as well. And so the dichotomy of we've chased out 25% of NASA in the last 2 years, but we want to rebuild NASA's core competency and have this new pipeline of talent. I don't know which of these is the real, you know, who's the real Slim Shady here to throw it back. It's tough. Are those, who's happy? Which of these lanes are happy right now? I don't know. And company, you know, SpaceX did not make the biggest IPO in history by hiring people that went through training elsewhere, right? They were coming straight out of good engineering schools, straight out of college, internships while they're in college, and were finding the people that were attracted to their culture from the very early days. Is this culture out of the academy compatible with what you're seeing in the SpaceX environment? Is it compatible with the Blue Origin? Is it more of a Stoke environment? Is it actually probably a better fit for the Space Force in a lot of ways if you're talking about operators? I don't know, man. Not my department, but it's a little head spinning.
Yeah, interesting. So a lot of domestic uncertainty for sure there. But Eric, as you wrote last week in some reporting, the Trump White House just tossed a grenade into international space relations. And this is in regard to a summit happening in France. Eric, this is kind of a wild story. Can you walk us through this one?
Yeah, and to be clear, it was Politico that originally had the story last week and some good reporting on their part. But basically, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has recognized the importance of space to the future of France and to Europe. And I think recognizes also that Europe is falling behind, not just the United States, but China in that regard. And so he wanted to have this big summit where he could bring together all the major players and talk about how they could collectively kind of build Europe's capabilities up in space and defense, communications, and so forth. And he was saying that U.S. commercial space industry has a lot of capabilities that would help us do that. And so we're open to them participating and buying their services. And the European market is important to a lot of commercial space companies in the United States. So the commercial space companies were invited. They called the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, sort of get some guidance. And the OSTP sort of looked into it and said, well, we have some concerns. And one of the concerns was that the summit might become a policy summit where they put out some position papers or platforms at the end that maybe are not in the best interests of U.S. commercial companies, like they're talking about spectrum allocation and issues like that. But there was also a kind of, I think, unsavory political dimension of this as well, where, let's face it, the Trump administration has not been friendly toward Europe or NATO. President Trump has been critical of NATO in many regards. He's spurned a lot of our allies overseas, a lot of our traditional space allies for sure. And I think there was also some kind of an element of let's embarrass Macron by not having the U.S. space companies show up at his space summit. And so we're left in a situation where I think some of the space companies said they're pulling out. Others are still sending officials. Some of the space officials were already in Paris when this happened last week at the summit. I think starts Wednesday, the 9th. It's kind of a mess. And the bigger picture to me is pretty disheartening because, you know, I sort of feel like Europe and the United States should be working together in space. And it should be okay for U.S. companies to buy European services. And it should be okay for European governments to buy U.S. space services. And we ought to work together on Artemis and so forth. And it's clear that the Trump administration would just love to continue to sort of snipe away at one of our historically closest allies, Europe.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Berger. He's the senior space editor at Ars Technica. And Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Anthony, is this new territory for commercial space companies where, you know, this administration has been quite friendly to commercial space and now they've got to walk a fine line?
Politics are weird, right? You've got a lot of commercial companies that will end up setting up offices within, you know, somewhere in Europe. Rocket Lab is a big name that you'll hear in that, right? Where they've bought Mynaric, a laser terminal company. They're going to set up a German subsidiary that's operating there. They're not alone in that. There's a lot of companies that are doing the same kind of thing because one of the topics from Europe lately has been, and lately, I mean, you know, probably the last 5 years, they've been talking about this a lot of some of the things that they would like sovereign access to. It's not just launch, right? They launch out of French Guiana. They've got their own launch vehicles, some good, some bad. You know, there's been, I think launch is the only thing we've really heard out of Europe in the last decades that they've said, we want our own version of this. And it's actually turned out. There's been a major upheaval in Europe in the last couple of years of like, what should we go work on now? Because we're not getting along with the US as much anymore. There was a moment where they were collaborating with China in terms of training astronauts. A lot of the astronaut corps within Europe have said, we want to have our own human spaceflight capability. That costs absolute ton of money. So like, do we actually have that? And then you've got some people actually migrating the other way over the ocean as well, right? The exploration company setting up shop down in Houston because they have some contracts that they find interesting to develop return capsules from the ISS. Could we go and be a human spaceflight company? There's some cross-pollination where companies are being opportunistic about, we see an opportunity in that market to go set up. But then you do have to play this geopolitic game of where are the priorities between these two governmental organizations? Even within Europe, there's some weird interplay between what is the EU and what is the European Commission and what do the actual launch companies want? You can make plans, but you've got to really map those every year around like, what is the state of the world and how can I best tack in this environment? How can I continue to be successful? And the ones that have a little bit of grittiness are the ones that actually find their way and become, you know, companies that we all talk about here on this show.
Europe is behind in a lot of key areas in terms of their commercial launch capabilities. ESA Aerospace, which had a lovely success this weekend with its Spectrum rocket, is essentially 18 years behind where SpaceX did with that with the Falcon 1. And so the commercial companies are starting up there, but they've got a long ways to go. So from a launch perspective, they're 10 or 15 years behind the United States in terms of the reusable launch revolution. From a human transportation standpoint, they're 10 to 15 years away from having that capability if they were to start developing it now, I think. From a commercial space station standpoint, they're partners with U.S. companies, not leading the way. They don't have the capability to mount a lunar mission on their own. You know, they're trying to do a Starlink-like constellation called Iris Squared, but it's already years late and going to be billions of dollars. And I think there are real questions about that. And so if the Europeans are, you know, really want to be serious players in space and they want to be independent of the United States, which, hey, I mean, given the way this administration has treated them, I think they need to be taking a hard look at sort of who their partners are for the future. They're going to need to make significant investments because a lot of these capabilities, they are partners with the United States or other countries rather than the leaders.
Interesting stuff to watch. So it has been a very busy summer for sure. There is still some runway left in this year. So to end out this conversation, I'm going to ask you both, what are some stories that you're watching for the remainder of 2026? I'll start with you, Anthony.
Starship is in a really interesting spot. One thing we probably should have mentioned in the SpaceX segment is that their recent test flights feel like the transition between testing like we've seen Starship so far, which every flight, every part of it is a test, to more like what we saw with the Falcon 9, where it would do something useful and then also test something else. When they can hit that point and they're starting to deploy actual satellites from Starship, that changes the game for Starship's flight rate, for the utility of it, the fact that it's not just a money loser, but it's actually starting to make them money. I think the curve on that changes quite a bit. Hard not to be focused on Blue Origin as well, getting back to the launch pad because of everything that's riding on New Glenn in the next couple of years. So the big rockets still have my attention because they move not only the industry forward, but then the Artemis program and everything else that we like to talk about. That's all really hinged on those two vehicles.
The Starship's development is probably the most important story for the rest of the year and next early part of next year. Especially, I'm looking forward to seeing when they can actually get the in-space propellant test where they transfer fuel from one Starship to another. You know, they were really hoping to do that this year. It's September now, so I'm thinking that's not happening this year. And who knows when it's going to happen in 2027, and that's critical to the Artemis 4 mission and beyond. This one of the stories I'm really fascinated with is looking forward for the rest of the year is the commercial space stations. The NASA's going to put out a final RFP soon for that, so we'll get a sense of what NASA ultimately ends up asking for, whether these commercial space stations can succeed in that. And I think the biggest question that's become a huge, huge, huge issue this summer is the fact that they don't have a reliable transportation system to get astronauts to these commercial space stations, especially if Crew Dragon is going to be retired in the mid-2030s, which I think is going to happen. And if that's the case, man, their business models are just in a world of hurt because they're going to have to rely, if they exist at all, on Boeing Starliner, Blue Origin space vehicle that's under development, or something else that doesn't exist yet. And that's just a very, very difficult place to be.
That was Eric Berger. He's the senior space editor at Ars Technica. We were also speaking with Anthony Colangelo. He hosts the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-hosts the podcast Off Nominal. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.